Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all, Canada's most irreverent talk show here, The Andrew Lawton Show, on this Monday, April 29th, 2024. Hope you are having a wonderful start to the week so far. I saw some of you, not a huge number, it was a smaller gathering by design at the Civitas conference in Vancouver over the weekend. It was on, well, I guess it was Friday, Saturday. So yeah, I guess that was pretty much over the weekend. But that was done where with very, very great work by my colleague Lindsay Shepherd, who put her organizational prowess to the test, and I think passed the test with room to spare. So that was a lot of fun. And one of the things that was interesting about it is I was able to speak to a couple of the people that were involved in politics that I interviewed when I was writing this bad boy right here, which I've got to do the shameless plug on. It comes out in exactly 1 month, less a day. Pierre Poilievre, A Political Life. It is a book-length biography of the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, who, again, things can change in the next year and 4 months, but at this point, the polls are showing is likely to be the next Prime Minister of Canada. Now, one of the things that there was an old joke, I forget who did it, it was in an American context, but it was, you know, if the election were held today, voters would be confused because that's not when it's supposed to be. Something to that effect. So if the election were held today, you can't necessarily extrapolate or project forward, but if the election were held today, the Conservatives would be on track. Let me pull up the latest projections here. Most likely to bring in 211 seats. That is about 40 seats more than they need for a majority. The Liberals will be down to 67, the Bloc Québécois at 39, the NDP at 24, and the Green Party with their lowly two seats. Those are the latest projections courtesy of 338 Canada, which has a pretty good batting average on this. I mean, pollsters always, you have to take their projections and forecasts with a bit of a grain of salt. But all of this is a lead into this fascinating story in the Hill Times that I wanted to get to here. The Hill Times has gotten a Liberal member of parliament who's leaked the details of this caucus meeting that Liberal MPs had with Justin Trudeau. And he's telling them not to worry. No, don't panic. Everything's going to be fine. You can't expect a dramatic boost in public support until next year. So yeah, don't look at the polls this year. You've got to wait until next year. That's when we're going to get them. And this is what the Liberal MP, and not named, but this is what they are quoted as saying to the Hill Times. Don't expect us to be neck and neck in 2 months or 6 months' time even. Instead, Trudeau is downplaying expectations. It's like treading water when you're drowning. He was telling us to not freak out while you're drowning, that you stay calm and you can get back to the top for a lot of the members who are below water. So this is this MP who is clearly not too thrilled with what Trudeau was telling them, trying to paraphrase it. But effectively, what this MP is saying, that Justin Trudeau is telling his caucus members, okay, I know it sucks now. I know it's going to suck in a couple of months. It's going to suck in 6 months, but wait until 2025. He's basically that friend that we all have when everything's going wrong, that says, guys, wait, I have a plan. And everyone around is kind of wondering if I think that the plan is probably going to be worse than what you've been doing up until this point. Because again, when you have been at the helm for 8 years as it is, it doesn't matter what your plan for the future is. You've already been the one who created this mess. Now, what's interesting is the Hill Times went to the PMO. They went to Justin Trudeau's office and said, why were you telling MPs not to expect any uptick in support over the next year? And this is the statement they got from the Prime Minister's press secretary. The priority of our government is ensuring fairness for every generation of Canadian. The government is focused on building more homes, making life more affordable, and growing our economy. So I wasn't even hearing like a remote attempt at an answer to the question that was asked. It's about fairness for every generation. They're still doing the, every time they say generational fairness, you have to take a drink. You'll be passed out drunk by, 9:30 a.m. on a Monday. But you know what? That is the rule that Justin Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland and all have put out here. Now, The polling, interestingly enough, is showing that Canadians are not going on board with the budget. They're not going along with the spending. Even the capital gains tax, which the Liberals thought would be really good at driving that wedge against the so-called wealthy, the 1%, all of that. Even the capital gains tax hasn't really attracted the level of support that the Liberals want. 74% of Canadians polled in an innovative research study done the other day said the budget will have a negative impact on the economy. 74%, 16% say it'll be positive. So when you put out your flagship budget that you think is going to be the piece of legislation that will turn around your flagging fortunes, and you get 16% of people in the country to say, yeah, I think that'll make things better, you have got a massive, massive problem on your hands. The Conservatives are on track to receive well over 40% of the vote. And this is distributed across the country. This isn't just in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Upper BC. This is in parts of the country that the Conservatives will need if they're going to have a majority. Now, look, the Conservatives have snatched defeat from the jaws of victory in the past. The 2019 election was a winnable one. This was the Justin Trudeau blackface election. The 2021 election was a winnable one. This was the so-called unnecessary election. So yes, Conservatives could absolutely bungle this, but if they have the right team of candidates, if the leader stays on track and stays on message, that part is especially critical, then we are able to, I think, turn things around a little bit. But what's fascinating about all of this is how unwilling Justin Trudeau is to look in the mirror. And I am not in the business of giving Liberal members of Parliament advice, and I should say they're not in the business of listening, even if I were to. But Liberal MPs have a tool in their toolbox that we never hear discussed. They could give Justin Trudeau the old Aaron O'Toole. They could give him the bums rush out of caucus. They have something called the Reform Act. As MPs, they are able to initiate a vote on Justin Trudeau's leadership, and they could have him out the door in one single caucus meeting. They could have a letter on a Monday or a Tuesday. They could send the letter if it was signed by, I forget the threshold, but a certain number of MPs. Then they could put this to a vote at a caucus meeting. And Justin Trudeau could literally be out the door as leader in nothing flat. But they're not doing that. They're not doing that. And I wonder how long Liberal MPs are going to sit down and accept what Justin Trudeau is telling them here, which is, no, I have a plan. We're going to turn it around. It's going to work out great. Don't you worry, guys. It's all going to be fine. Obviously, the MP that leaked the details of this caucus meeting to the Hill Times wasn't satisfied. We know there have been a couple of other little ones that we are going to see here as well. But what's fascinating to me in all of this is that we have not seen more Liberals just for self-preservation alone say, you know what, we want to lengthen our careers. We want to lengthen the time that we have around here. Some of them may have just thrown in the towel and they say, look, we know we're not going to win again. We know we're done. Let's just ride this out until the bitter end. Other ones, though, are not so easily hoodwinked, you'd think. There are some MPs, let me just go back to those 338 projections for a moment. Liberals could go to 67 seats. Now, there's a range there, anywhere from 50 to 94, but 67 is kind of the sweet spot right now that the 338 projections are saying. So if you're one of those 67 and you want to make sure you get reelected, you need a Liberal Party that's going to put its best foot forward. And I've always maintained that Justin Trudeau's biggest threat is going to come not from Canadian voters, but from his own caucus. That was my theory. I've started softening on the theory a little bit because there has been no movement in that caucus. But my goodness, for just their own survival, the Liberals need to get rid of this guy. Now, that would probably not be what Pierre Poilievre wants. If you're Pierre Poilievre and the Conservative team, you're probably champing at the bit to get a Liberal led by Justin Trudeau, a Liberal Party led by Trudeau, because then you can be the change party. You can be the anti-Trudeau when clearly this guy is not resonating. If you caught my show last week, I was talking about how hilarious it is that Justin Trudeau thinks the problem is that Canadians haven't heard from him enough. So he's been going on this podcast tour. He was doing the podcast with Vox last week. He did one with Freakonomics. I should have actually pulled something in his interview with them that I found hilarious. He called himself a social activist. A social activist. This is what he said. The exact quote here. I'm ultimately a social activist who's going to look to how I can have a positive impact on the world. You are the Prime Minister of Canada. You are the head of government of this country. You have won 3 elections. You've had tremendous opportunity to put whatever change in place that you want. And he is still trying to say, oh, I'm just this left-wing progressive activist type, which, I mean, look, maybe you want to say he is. But the thing about activists is that activists are not actor. I mean, he's an actor in the sense of, you know, drama teacher. But the thing about him is that he is in a position where he could be actioning things that he wants. And the progressives, I think, were fed up with him even before people on the right were, because the progressives had such high hopes for him that he didn't deliver on. It's like, okay, he gets in, he legalizes pot. Everything else just kind of goes by the wayside. He hasn't reconciled with Indigenous people. He hasn't fixed gender inequality. He hasn't done all of this. It's just been window dressing, and people have absolutely tired of it. Now, I do want to do, just before we move on to our next guest here, I want to do a little bit of an I told you so moment. So, this past weekend, Vashi Kapelos on CTV did a sit-down interview with, or sorry, she did a, she did a sit-down interview with the president of Poland, and she asked a question that I think is a very well-suited one for leaders of European nations. This is that clip.
I want to ask you a bit about your visit specifically here to Canada. You mentioned defense spending. I'll get to that in a moment. You're here at an energy conference, and I have spoken to a number of other European leaders in the past few months about Canadian energy in particular and efforts underway in Europe to wean itself off of any kind of dependence on Russia. Poland has been largely successful in that so far. I'm wondering, though, when it comes to, in particular, liquefied natural gas, if that is a Canadian product Poland is interested in.
Oczywiście, że tak.
Of course, yes. If only Canada is ready to supply its LNG gas to Poland, we have got our LNG terminal in Świnoujście right now. It has got reloading capacities. We're extending them. We are extending the terminal. And we also have plans to set up another LNG terminal in the port of Gdańsk. If Canada offered its LNG to us, and if this gas could be bought attractively at attractive prices, well, we have been receiving gas from US companies. We have been receiving gas also from Qatar. In the same way, we would be ready to negotiate, to talk, and to accept Canadian gas as well. Even more so that there is an investment connected with one of the LNG terminals on the eastern coast of Canada, and there is our PKA Orlen, our concern, our company participating in that.
So he's saying there, oh, absolutely, yeah, we love Canadian LNG. We'd like to buy it right now. We have to get some from the U.S., but also some from Qatar. We'd rather buy from Canada. Let's get a good market price. If only the Canadian government were willing to offer it. And this is a great question. It was a phenomenal answer, not all that a surprising answer. Energy independence and energy security are crucial in Europe. Countries that don't want to have to be reliant on Russian oil and gas will be able to buy from elsewhere, if only elsewhere is willing to sell it. So Justin Trudeau, he's the guy that gets up there and says, oh, there's no business case. But why I found that interview with the Polish, the head of Poland so fascinating is because I had said something 2 weeks ago at the Canada Strong and Free Network conference that proved eerily prescient.
I must say, I've been quite surprised that Justin Trudeau keeps inviting European heads of government and state here, because every time they come, they all do an interview with, you know, Vashi Kapelos or something and say, oh, I'd love to buy LNG. And then Justin Trudeau has to come out and say, ah, oh, there's no business case.
Am I right or am I right? I even got the interviewer right. I said, oh, yeah, every time the European heads of state come, it's Vashi Kapelos they sit down with and say they want to buy Canadian LNG. And not 2 weeks later, here we have the Polish president coming, and I'm only, he's the president, right? Not the prime minister. I get them mixed up in these, these new fandangled republics and all of that. The constitutional monarchy is the right one. He is the president, but the fascinating thing is this is literally happening every time one of these European heads of government or heads of state comes here. They're asked the very obvious, very sensible question. They give the obvious, sensible answer. And in the end, we are all forced to deal with the fact that Canada is the one putting barriers and roadblocks here. I want to shift gears to an entirely different topic. You may have seen in Montreal that the very worst of American academia has been imported to Canada in the sense that there is now an encampment at McGill University in Montreal that is inhabited and occupied by these anti-Israel protesters that are making all sorts of demands, among others, that the university divests its endowment funds from anything connected to Israel, that it severs ties as a school with Israeli enterprise. And we've also heard reports of very anti-Semitic rhetoric and statements, students being harassed for no other reason than their Jewish identity and the values that a lot of Jews, most Jews have, of supporting the state of Israel's right to exist. And what was fascinating about this is that McGill has kind of just said, shucks. They've given very little in the way of any sort of pushback, as we have an encampment that is now entrenching itself and will soon, I suspect, balloon to other campuses. Barbara Kay is a columnist with the National Post and the Epoch Times, and I actually got to see her over the weekend briefly at the Civitas conference. Barbara, always lovely to see you. Thanks so much for coming on today.
A pleasure, Andrew.
Oh, you're muted there. Oh, perfect. I got your audio now. Let me ask you, Barbara, first off, about whether you're surprised by this. I mean, you've lived in Montreal for, I don't know about all your life, but certainly for many years, and you've seen what's happened since October 7th. Was this unexpected at McGill?
No, not at all, because this is kind of like a meme right now. In fact, I can't believe there would be a university campus anywhere in North America that would consider itself respectable if it didn't have something like this going on in an encampment, because that's what is done to show what a great social activist you are. And especially, it would be especially anticipated at universities where there's a large Jewish presence, as there is at McGill. So no, it doesn't surprise me at all.
How about McGill's response to this? Because they've basically, in a lot of ways, it looks like they've washed their hands of it. And we had students that were sent out through the Student Association, which is supposed to be, I don't know, advocating on things like tuition fees, instead send out students the death toll in Gaza, which based on, you know, very, very sketchy numbers from the, you know, Gazan Health Authority, there we go, just basically pinning the deaths of 31,000 people on Israel. And this is the type of rhetoric that students at McGill are being bombarded with.
Well, they're not specific about who's dying or how many. It might be that 30,000 have been killed, but what they don't specify is that according to Israel, 13,000 of them have been terrorists, and Hamas has not denied that. So the ratio of those killed to civilians killed to militants is actually, in urban warfare of this kind, quite low. But you know, they'll tell you all kinds of things because they get their information from sources that are not reliable. They are determined to make their case for support against Israel. That's their main concern, is to call Israel out as an evil nation. And that's the message. And they're delighted to be active like this on campus. This is what students do. You may remember in 1968, there were similar demonstrations against the Vietnam War, and they were also taking over the campuses. In fact, that was our first experience of students actually taking over campuses and the administration losing control of the of what was happening on their own campuses. Of course, in those days, the message was peace and love, and now it's intifada and hate, so that's changed. But I did expect it, and I agree with you that the administration is acting in a very namby-pamby way because they're not quite sure what to do, and they're afraid to take muscular action as is required.
Well, and one of the things, that, and again, you always end up when you're talking about any display of this nature with this whataboutism. And, you know, a lot of people that had no issue with the Freedom Convoy in Ottawa are saying they want police to come in and crack skulls here. And the flip side, people that wanted police to crack skulls in Ottawa with the Freedom Convoy are saying, oh, no, this is the right to protest. So I think there's hypocrisy all around. But the one point I'll stress here is that universities have a demonstrable track record of treating different demonstrations differently. Like, I bet if the McGill University Pro-Life Society were to stage a sit-in, they would be gone in no time. And here we have an encampment of this nature. It's very anti-Israel, bordering on, depending on the rhetoric of the individual person, anti-Semitic. And McGill's saying, well, we'd like to come up with a resolution. We'll try to talk. We'll try to engage. And that's not a group that they afford to other groups.
No, they're afraid of this group. They're not afraid to act, as you say, with politically incorrect groups such as pro-lifers. They certainly wouldn't tolerate for one second, people that are saying we're anti-immigration or in any way asserting themselves as white Canadians or anything like that. There's a set menu for who is considered racialized and who's considered the victim, and the Palestinians are one of them. And it does not occur to them that these expressions of hatred for Jews, because Jews are not on the victim list, to say, you know, for this one time, we have to agree, the numbers of anti-Semitic incidents and hate incidents are so high, I think we're going to just have to include this group of Jews on our campus as amongst the racialized, and we can't let this continue to happen. In the United States, we have seen states, Florida and Texas, where the governors have said, no, this just isn't happening. You private universities have codes of conduct. You're not applying them. And by the way, of course, McGill has a code of conduct, just like all the other universities. They are not applying their code of conduct. Their code of conduct does not allow for harassment on the basis of nationality or affiliation of any kind with, I mean, they may not like Zionism. That's too bad. For Jews, well, for most Jews.
I think you froze there for a moment, or at least it did on, oh, I got you back now. Sorry, I might be on my end here. This is the glory of doing things live. But I'll ask you about let me take a step back here. If we talk about what's led us to this point, there have been people sounding the alarm about the increasing rhetoric, the ratcheting up of language. You know, at first it was, not at first, but early on, we saw people protesting businesses, especially in Toronto, that just happened to have a peripheral connection to Israel or no connection at all. It was just connected to someone who was Jewish. And then you go to this protest against McGill. Of all the people complicit in what Israel is doing, if you want to believe that Israel is in the wrong here, I put McGill University very low on that list. So the idea of targeting your ire at McGill when you have an issue with Israel and the IDF and the Mossad and all of that is absurd. And even if they got what they want or what they say they want, and McGill were to divest its funds from Israel, which is not even handled by the university, they have an external fund there, and sever ties with Israeli academics, you're changing nothing. Like, so that's the issue, is that it's not even like it's an effective protest, because their issue, they claim, is with Israel. And I think when you look at it through that lens, it becomes apparent their issue isn't with Israel. Their issue is much broader than that.
I think it is broader. Of course, it's very anti-Western as well as anti-Israel. And they know that they're probably not going to change the all their efforts at boycotts of Israel have failed, because it's not in their gift to tell the university where to place their funds. And they know that, but they are going after hearts and minds. They have been very successful in that endeavor. And the more noise they make on the campuses, and it's a central place, it lends itself to, you know, big open spaces to encamp. The universities could end this very quickly by taking the ringleaders and expelling them. That's what they have done in Florida and in Texas, and it's been very effective. That's the end of the protest. They could expel 100 students or suspend 100 students. They could end this very easily. So these students are activating either knowingly or unknowingly for a revolution. And to do that, they have to change what's acceptable to what is unacceptable. They have to turn Jews into pariahs. We saw that at Columbia, that Jews were advised to go home. They weren't safe. They caused the university to have to go on to online classes. This is a big victory for them, because they are showing a lot of muscle, and people get the message. We had better start appeasing these people, or things could get violent and out of control. I think it's very obvious what is happening, and the only way to combat it is very swiftly and to enforce your own codes of conduct. And it's at a certain stage, it's easy to do, and later on, it isn't so easy to do. Why they have chosen the path of appeasement, perhaps it's because the message from the top, from our prime minister, is non-messaging. and he doesn't seem to care about the rampant anti-Semitism that finds its ground zero at the universities, but spreads with the demonstrations all through society. It creates a mood. It creates a mood. It creates a feeling that, well, maybe, you know, if they're that angry, maybe they're right. And it does change hearts and minds. So they are winning the propaganda war with these tactics. And so I'm sorry to see it. And I'm sorry that so many intelligent people in the administration are failing to do their duty. Sad.
One of my favorite Canadian columnists, Barbara Kay. Always a pleasure, Barbara.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. And this is going to get worse before it gets better. And by that, I think the first step is that we'll see this balloon at other university campuses. I think it was Ottawa U, which has preemptively said, yeah, we're not going to stand for this. I mean, if you want to try it at Ryerson, well, you can't say Ryerson anymore. If you want to try it at Toronto Metropolitan University, you have to basically a homelessness encampment on the streets of downtown Toronto. So you might have to move over some tents to build yours. But, you know, at other schools, I don't see this as being all that out of place. Now, I mean, how many students want to stick around once exams are done? I don't know. And in that sense, it's a little bit less disruptive than had they done this during the school year. And I wonder if that's going to be the excuse we hear from the schools of, oh, well, you know, our campus is pretty much empty anyway this summer, some nonsense like that. So I'm not, by the way, taking the anti-free speech view. I believe that you have a right to express your opinion. I do believe that at times you can be disruptive in doing that. I also believe that you have a right to enforce your property, and that's what these universities are only selectively doing, as we see. So with that, let's pivot back to the topic we kept us going on last week, which was plastics. We had the big UN Plastics Conference in Ottawa. The federal government announced the forthcoming plastics registry. Countries around the world, including Canada, working towards a plastics treaty. Now, I should have done the plastic straw gag again. I don't know if, Sean, we have that photo we can pull for later on, but you may recall when the Supreme Court struck down the federal government's plastics ban, I celebrated by a big giant batch of plastic straws that had been, you know, hidden away because I didn't want the plastic police to come knocking and collect them. And then we saw a lot of Canadians very happy about that because Canadians hate, no one likes paper straws. Not even the people that make them don't like them. No one likes paper straws. They're terrible. But Stephen Guilbeault said this.
I feel that there's large consensus on the fact that we need to ban certain single-use plastics. We need to do better and increase recycled content for the fabrication of plastics. And I've even heard some very large multinationals tell me, we want to have access to recycled plastics so we don't need to use virgin plastics anymore. We need to do a better job in designing plastics so that they can be more easily reusable or recyclable. We need to do a better job on labeling. And I think all of these things, or many of these things, we can agree that we all need to do that, everyone around the world, so that there is a level playing field and we don't end up with a patchwork of policies and measures around the world. And that even the private sector is calling for. Large multinationals are saying we need a legally binding plastics treaty, which is obviously in stark contrast with the position of the Conservative Party of Canada, who just issued a petition saying we need to bring back plastic straws because there's no environmental problem with plastics, where there are 200 countries in the world, Unilever, Pepsi, and Coca-Cola, who profoundly disagree with the Conservative Party of Canada's position on plastic pollution.
A consensus. Maybe there's a consensus among the types of people with whom Stephen Guilbeault cavorts. You often find them scaling buildings and getting arrested. Maybe there is a consensus among those people, but there's not a consensus among ordinary Canadians that the plastics ban is the way to go and that plastic straws should be just relegated to exile here. I want to welcome in our old friend Chris Sims, our Monday correspondent and the Alberta director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Chris, what about you? Are you hearing this rumored consensus around the plastics ban?
Of the ban on plastic straws. You probably saw, of course, the famous now picture of Premier Danielle Smith, your co-host. Is she still your radio co-host? Are you still?
I don't know. I've never been technically relieved of my guest hosting duty, so I'm not sure.
Andrew is always on standby at any moment to step in as Alberta Premier. So just in case he throws down the microphone and leaves, that's what he has to go do. So yeah. Premier Danielle Smith had a pretty funny joke where she had, I think she was drinking a ginger ale, and she had two plastic straws shoved together, and she was drinking it like this. And it's one of those things, right, where I think it's more than just it being silly to have this kind of gross paper straw that's disintegrating in your drink. I think it's because this has really gotten up into people's faces, right? Like what you're choosing to eat with, right? What you're choosing to eat, that sort of stuff. That's really kind of a domestic personal choice. And I think the plastic straw thing versus the paper straw thing really bugged people. And so I think it's emblematic really of how this government is operating. What I found interesting is that it sounds now like he's trying to make noise that perhaps a global treaty on plastics and everybody agreeing on plastics might be too complicated. That's the first time I have ever heard that minister tap the brakes on anything. Now, I could be misinterpreting him, but some of the tone that was coming from Minister Guilbeault there, I found a little bit more slowed down than he usually is. I'll also point out that people just don't want these sorts of bans. So in the city of Edmonton, for example, there's now this big bag fee. It's 15 cents per bag, and then it's going to be going up to 25 cents per bag. Pretty soon it's going to be $2 per reusable bag. You know, those things that are filling up all of our sink cupboards and all of our pantries, at least speaking for myself. And so that's really costing people a lot of money, and people are pushing back on it. They push back on it so hard in Calgary, Andrew, that they've had to repeal it. So Calgary tried doing this whole, you're going to have to pay every single time you use a bag. And now they've had to back off on it completely. So I think they are getting some serious pushback on this.
Yeah. And I mean, my view on the plastic straws thing has never been that plastic straws are my hill to die on. It's that a government that's going to regulate something so small and so minor will also regulate the big things that do matter. And I think you need to push back against these small incursions. And to be fair, a lot of companies now are keeping with the plastic straws. Now, I don't know if that's just because they're buying into the environmental argument, or if it's just because they're not exactly confident that the ban won't be reimposed, or they had to invest so much in all of this inventory and redo their supply chains around it, whatever the case is. But I've never been against individual companies doing that. It's always been when government is the one that manages it and manipulates it. And absolutely, if they're going to, because that's how regulation comes. That's how government grows. They regulate the things that people are already doing, and then they start encroaching a little bit more on other things. And at a certain point, the regulatory regime has gotten so large, you can't really dismantle it.
Yes, exactly. And before you know it, you're trying to balance all of your groceries leaving the store. In fact, just this past weekend, when I managed to go get our groceries, I was watching this lady, and she clearly, you know, I don't know if she didn't have the money to buy another bag on top of another bag that she must have forgotten in her car, but she was trying to leave. And you know those little roast chickens that come in like the plastic container thingy, and they've got the little cardboard sleeve? She had three of them in her hand. Like she'd grabbed like this, like without the bag, and she's trying to get past the lottery counter, and they're about to fall out. And so luckily one of the checkout ladies ran after her and just gave her a paper bag, like, shh, don't tell anyone here. Right. And she managed to make it to her store. And this is what I'm getting at is, yeah, is that the hill to die on? Well, logically, no. But that's such a personal thing, right? They're right up in your grill, right at the grocery store counter all the time. They're right there for your meal with your family at the restaurant all the time. And to your point, I think that then is what gives them more incursion into your life. And further, on the idea of a global issue when it comes to plastics, a couple of years ago, it was in the New York Post, and I'm trying to recall from memory here, I think they reported that 9 out of 10 of the plastic polluting rivers in the world were in Asia and in Africa. Meaning this is not a problem, you know, that terrible idea of the garbage patch and the big floating amount of plastics pollution in the ocean. It's not coming from North America, and it's not coming from Europe. So why the strange impositions on Canadians? Like, I have never seen someone pick up, you know, a coffee cup and throw it into a river. People would have a stroke in Canada if you watch somebody do that. Further, I often see volunteer organizations from every walk of life. That's often what they'll go do, is pick up litter in the spring and make sure our shorelines are nice and clean. And so it would be probably smarter for the Trudeau government to encourage that sort of behavior instead of always with the stick, which doesn't result in anything.
Yeah. And a lot of the, I mean, it's funny because the government will always use moments where it believes it has political capital to do big things. So in Canada, we've seen firearms law that have done this. A lot of the push for a plastics ban came after that viral video of a sea turtle, a poor sea turtle that had a plastic straw suck up its nose. It was tragic. It was difficult to watch. It also was not Canadians' problem and it was not Canadians' fault. This was the, you mentioned it earlier, this was the Danielle Smith picture where she celebrated the plastics ban and engaged in a consumption of ginger ale there. I still like mine better, though, this because I was a bit more celebratory, I think, than the premier was. There we go. Yeah, that was
reminds
mine.
Take that, sea turtles. Take that, sea turtles. Oh,
yeah,
you
no
know
sea
what?
Turtles were harmed in the making of that gag. But again, it's the little things that matter.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? The sea turtle picture, and I remember it because it was very impressionable, right? And it's awful. It reminds me, I grew up in the 80s. It reminds me of this video footage that all of us 80s kids saw of, you know, those six ring plastic things that go around a six pack?
Oh, yeah, showed, yeah, yeah. The, yeah.
It showed a duck.
I was going to describe them and I realized you already did. I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah, yeah. It showed a duck and this poor bird, this waterfowl, I don't remember what kind of duck, sorry, but this waterfowl had this around its neck. And I remember this video was everywhere, and this is way before the interwebs, kids, but it really made an impression. And so now you can find, like, any Gen Xer, if you watch them with those things, they're snipping them into little tiny pieces before they
My wife does that as well, and I always wonder, maybe she got the video.
I guarantee you she saw the video of this duck. And so this is my point, is that people who are in a position to care do care, and they take efforts to make sure that they aren't endangering the environment. And I think that's what annoys people a lot, is when they see something like this coming from the Trudeau government saying, you know what, guys, I've got this. How about you guys figure out how to balance the budget or maybe run the passport office in town? I can figure out my recycling in my own home. And on top of this, if they start getting into something like a plastics registry, I just shudder to think at how much money they're going to spend on this. To your point earlier, with the failed long gun registry, we wound up blowing almost $2 billion on that thing. And it didn't make Canadians any safer from the lawful duck hunters here in Canada. Same thing going with this current gun confiscation. Mm-hmm. Again, taking firearms away from law-abiding firearms owners. They haven't seized a single one yet, and they've already blown millions of dollars. So just imagine what kind of money they could burn with the plastics registry here in Canada.
So I wanted to move to your old province here for a moment, British Columbia. British Columbia is a useful test case for a lot of things. I think for drug policy, it's been a useful test case now, because this is what happens when the decriminalization harm reduction left gets its way. But also on the carbon tax, because BC had a carbon tax. I was going to say before it was cool. It's not cool now. But BC had a carbon tax before the federal government pushed one. So we've got a fair bit of runway in BC to see what a carbon tax does. And shocking answer is, Chris?
Emissions have gone up, not down with a carbon tax. And thank you for giving me a chance to highlight this, because this is something that was brought up. I did a debate. Sorry, I talked to another show host, but it wasn't for very long and I didn't.
All right, get lost.
I did a debate on TVO with Steve Paikin. I wasn't debating him, but I was debating a University of Ottawa professor. And he said something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing, well, emissions in British Columbia have gone down. No, they have not. And in fact, if you pull up the government website and you can pull up the actual data, I don't know if you guys have the screen captures there. It looks like a super boring website, but you can click on something called provincial inventory. And it pulls up this spreadsheet and it goes way back to, like, you know, the 1990s, right? So there we go. So this is the British Columbia government website. If you click on the provincial inventory there, where you see that hyperlink, and it pops up into an Excel sheet. And from there, you can take a look at the data. So the BC Liberal government, led by then Premier Gordon Campbell, introduced the provincial carbon tax in British Columbia back in 2008. So it came into effect in fiscal year 2008-2009. Back then, just to note, they introduced it as being revenue neutral. On paper, it was, because they did do a corresponding income tax cut that year, but very quickly it became just a huge tax grab. So, spoiler alert. But if you go to the actual data site and you take a look starting in 2009, You can see how many total megatons of carbon, CO2, was emitted that year. Then if you follow along, 10 years, okay? So 10 years is usually a good data set. Go from 2009 to 2019, emissions went up, Andrew, by more than 7%. Even if we wanted to include the terrible years of when people were locked in their homes or businesses were shut down and they weren't allowed to travel, right, during the pandemic and the lockdown years of 2020, 2021, it still went up by nearly 2%. So this is the whole point. When the BC government first hatched this carbon tax back in 2008, which, by the way, is the model, the Trudeau government has said out loud that British Columbia is their model for the carbon tax. So what you see there, they're the canary, right? So they promised back in 2008 that their carbon tax would stop at $30 a ton, be revenue neutral, reduce emissions, and that they would provide a whole bunch of alternative, affordable energy sources. None of those things is true today.
The problem that I have with this is that the sensible response is that someone says, oh, wow, I guess this isn't working. But that's never the way they go. The way they go is, wow, we're not doing it aggressively enough, or it would have been worse if we didn't. And that's the most challenging part of this, is that you're making an incredibly valid point that will be completely reversed in meaning by the people that brought us in here in the first place.
You're right. And that is often what they say. So on the first one, wow, that means we're not doing it hard enough. Okay, what do you guys want? Like, you already see record lineups for food banks, okay? You already see people not being able to afford to heat their homes. So the average Alberta family, for example, is going to be out more than $900 this year, net, with the carbon tax. That's caused by the carbon tax. The folks in British Columbia, they're getting screwed even more, frankly, Andrew, because by the time a two-person working family hits around $72,000 a year, around there out there, they get zero for a rebate. So if you are a hairdresser and you're married to a grocery store manager, you're not getting any rebate in British Columbia. Like, all of the middle class there is getting completely screwed on the carbon tax. So my question to them then would be, okay, what do you want? You want people freezing to death in the dark? What do you mean do it harder? And secondly, the idea that, oh, well, if we hadn't done it, it would have been higher than it would have been. That's magical thinking, because we can't know. Like, we cannot know that. And what's interesting here is that politicians will promise you all sorts of things, like I mentioned. They said it was going to stop at $30 a ton, be revenue neutral, reduce emissions, all that great stuff. And then when their scheme doesn't work out, they run out onto the pitch and they move those goalposts really fast. I've also heard people say, oh, well, you know, there's more people there now. Okay, so what then? You want to shut down immigration to British Columbia? Is that your plan? Because none of this makes sense. Every single time they try to set something up, it doesn't work and it doesn't make sense. And what's super frustrating is that when you give them a mathematical solution of, okay, tackle the big end of the arithmetic problem, sell natural gas, to your point with the Polish leader there, sell natural gas to India, reduce their super heavy duty emissions. They don't like that answer. They're clinging to this carbon tax in almost a religious way, even though it's not working.
Yeah, very well said. All right. Well, great points all around, Chris. We will check. Oh, no, I'm off next Monday. So we'll check in with you in 2 weeks.
Oh,
but thank you so much, as always, for coming on. Always great to talk to you, Chris, from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation.
Safe travels.
All right. Thank you. And that does it for me. Don't worry. You got me the rest of the week still, folks. We will be back tomorrow in just 23 hours and 15 minutes here on The Andrew Lawton Show, Canada's most irreverent talk show with True North. Thank you. God bless. And good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.